Welcome to the Determined Truth Podcast.
What the truth? You can't handle the truth.
Where we aim to explore questions of truth, the scriptures, and what it means for the church today. Here are your hosts, Rob Dalrymple and Vinny Angelo.
Hey everyone, welcome. This is episode 2 or 3 of the Millennium, Rob.
This is 3.
Okay, we're not going to go 1,000 episodes, so we'll just go 3, hopefully. I think we should end it today. Wait, this should be...
We will do our best.
Okay.
We will do our best. We're learning not to make promises, though.
Exactly. We're just hopes and thoughts and prayers. Yeah. So we're just going to just address a few more things. We spent a lot of time looking at the first 3 verses of Revelation 20 last week. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to get at least to verse 10 today. That's the goal. We've defined a little bit of the theological categories of Revelation 20 in terms of premillennial, postmillennial, amillennial. I don't know if we want to just refresh that again, because these things, this could be just such a confusing topic. Sure. I don't know, for me, anytime when I started studying this, it took a long time of hearing it the same thing over and over. It's like, okay, now I think I get it. And most people are probably there as well. So, Ed, do we want to review any of that at all?
Yeah, that'd be a good idea. I really think that by the time we're done today, hopefully we will have, looking at the context of Revelation 20, which is the key passage for the millennium, and framed it in such a way that I think we have pretty much a definitive answer to this issue that, as we discussed on our first episode, for years, I thought, no, there's just no way you can ever come up with a definitive answer. So here we go. All right. So you have the millennium, which simply means 1,000 years, and it refers to the 1,000-year reign of Christ. Mm-hmm. So Christ is going to reign on earth for 1,000 years. What does that mean? Now, premillennialism says that Christ reigns on earth after he returns. So the pre refers to the second coming. The coming of Christ happens before the millennium. They take Revelation 19 and 20 as chronological. So Christ returns, rules from Jerusalem on a physical earth for 1,000 years. And there's a lot more convolutedness to that whole discussion that we won't get into. Now, one of the things about premillennialism that we didn't discuss, by the way, is the idea that premillennialism often comes with a pessimistic view of the present world. Things are actually going to get worse and worse until Christ returns. This Armageddon idea, dispensational idea, that things get worse. There'll be wars and rumors of wars, like birth pangs. They read that into the text and say, oh, all that will get more and more intense, earthquakes and all these bad things. And then Christ returns and saves us and establishes 1,000-year reign on earth in peace. That view then says that the devil is in the abyss literally for 1,000 years. Then there's postmillennialism, which is not very popular, not very prevalent, but it made a little bit of a revival. I think you and I alluded to it in the first episode with the Y2K stuff. The idea of postmillennialism says the second coming of Christ happens post-millennium, after the millennium. So Christ rules from the hearts of believers because the world's become Christianized and almost everyone becomes a Christian. And then Jesus reigns through them for 1,000 years, maybe not a literal 1,000 years. And then Christ returns. All right. And then you have the amillennial viewpoint. Now, literally would mean no millennium, but that's not the idea. The idea of amillennialism is that Christ reigns presently through the hearts of believers, but not because the world's become Christianized, but just because Christ lived, died, rose again as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, ascended into heaven, sat down on his throne, and said, now I'm making you guys kings, as he says to his disciples in Luke 22. You guys are kings and queens and priests of the earth. Go make my kingdom known throughout the world. And the church reigning as Christ is the millennial reign. Now, the idea of that would be that Satan is not literally bound in the abyss, but Satan's binding is only a binding so that he won't deceive the nations.
We hope you're enjoying the podcast, and we want to remind you that everything we do at Determined Truth, the podcast, Rob's blog, and our YouTube channel is available on the Determined Truth app. Directions on how to download the app is available in the show notes and on the DeterminedTruth.com website. Just click on the app tab.
What I have noticed, as we discussed here, I think week one, a little bit week two, and we'll get into a lot more today, and that is that these ideas of pre, post, and amillennial really try to analyze the description of the millennium in verses 4, 5, and 6. And what does it mean? They reign with Christ for 1,000 years. The rest of the dead didn't come to life until 1,000 years were completed. You know, and they try to parse all that out, the language, everything else. And I think what they've missed is the structure of the text, of the larger structure of the book of Revelation that we've discussed, as well as the structure of this unit. And we'll review that a little bit here in just a second. And then I think the second thing that they miss is the literary connections that John makes that we've been pointing out all along throughout our study. Once we got to chapter 14 and 15, we started going, okay, remember he said this earlier? Remember he said that earlier? Remember he said that? And you start making these links that John, I think, clearly wants us to see. But let me give that structural context one last time. And that is this. So chapter 19, 11 through 21, 8 is this, what I've called a bridge section. It's in between the section of the bride and the section of the harlot. So the harlot is in chapter 17, 1 through 19, 10. And then the bride is in chapter 21, 9 through 22, 9. Both accounts of two women. We'll discuss that even more when we get into the bride again, but we discussed that in our account of the harlot Babylon. In the middle of that, 19, 11 through 21, 8, you have this one section. And this, it's a bridge section, and it's got five units in it. The first unit is the return of Jesus, 19, 11 through 16. The last unit is a description of the descent or the introduction to the descent of the New Jerusalem. So Christ descends in 19, 11 through 16, and then introduction of the descent of the New Jerusalem in 21, 1 through 8. In the middle of that, you have three other units, and these three other units describe the enemies of Christ and of the kingdom of the church being judged. Chapter 19, verses 17 through 21, you have the judgment of the beast and the false prophet, and they're thrown in the lake of fire. In 20, verses 1 through 10, which is what we're on here today, the millennium passage, you have the judgment of Satan or the devil, and he's thrown in the lake of fire. And then in chapter 20, verses 11 through 15, you have the judgment of death and Hades, and they're thrown in the lake of fire. That's really critical. Now, as far as this unit is concerned, 21 through 10, it breaks up into three different subunits. And that's verses 1, 2, and 3 introduce Satan as though he's a new character, as if we didn't know who he was. The ancient dragon, who is the devil and Satan. We already knew that. In fact, it almost says exactly what was said in Revelation 12 when the dragon was first introduced. That was strange and curious. And then in verses 4 through 6, you have this interruption. If the account of 21 through 10 is a description of the judgment of Satan who's thrown in the lake of fire, that account is interrupted in verses 4 through 6 with the people of God who come to life and reign with Christ for 1,000 years. And then in verses 7 through 10, Satan's released from the abyss, goes out to make war against Christ and the saints, most likely. Fire comes out from heaven and devours them, and then the devil's thrown in the lake of fire. Okay, there we go. So what we finished with, or what we were discussing last time, Vinny, was the literary connections with this unit, verses 1 through 10 of chapter 20, and Revelation chapter 9. I think that's where we want to pick off.
I think the struggles that people get into on this, because you had started your last few minutes of sharing saying, it seems pretty clear that this is the way it ought to be read. It's pretty definitive that it should be this way. And I would agree with you. I would say from my perspective as someone, and you might share the sentiment as well, someone coming out of a dispensational premillennial background, coming from that background, as well as still working in a local church where, from a popular standpoint, folks are going to assume premillennialism.
Okay, yep.
The thing that I think is the biggest stumbling block to this conversation is exactly the two problems that you just listed, which is people not accounting for structure and the literary connections, because we start the conversation immediately parachuting into chapter 20.
Yes, exactly.
And then along with that, from a literary standpoint, it's assuming that the literary context is literal, which is obviously one of the hallmarks of dispensationalism, is historical, grammatical, literal reading of the text. Right. Yeah, I think if it makes sense why we would read Revelation 20 in a literal premillennial way, if that hermeneutical presupposition, to use a lot of syllables, if that is actually true, if that's the way John intended to be read. And I think the point that we're trying to make, and I think most scholars are trying to make, is if you were to zoom out, if you were to Google Earth out and look at the whole book at once, where you can see the whole thing and not just this parachuted, in there, this worm eyes view where you're right on the ground, you're going to see, no, there are these connections that should be made. So I think we, once again, like, start with the sentiment of charity. We understand that there's different Christian positions. We don't think we should split over this. We understand why people read this in a premillennial or postmillennial way. However, we just don't think putting the whole aggregate together of the story, that's the best way it should be read.
And there's still going to be, like, even with what we're going to discuss today in terms of how I think the text should be read, there's still going to be, what do you do with Isaiah 11? What do you do with Isaiah 65? Oh, okay, that's fine. We're not going to actually go into those conversations. I think it'll just be too far afield and make the conversation maybe too convoluted a little bit and get lost. You can't see the forest because of the trees. So let's stick to the text. Let's look what it says. And here's what I think. And then you can go home and wrestle with what you want to do with Isaiah 65 and Isaiah 11 and other passages like that, and figure those out later on.
In a context in my local church yesterday, I was having a conversation, and it was on the context or the topic of spiritual gifts. And the thing that I made the point on is we have these topics like a spiritual gifts, the foreknowledge of God, eschatology, these sorts of things where there's different Christian positions that are held. And we like to wrap things up. We like to synthesize things.
Yes, yes.
I think there's some positions that are stronger than others in all those types of topics.
Exactly.
But all theological constructs are going to leave something where they have some sort of unanswered question. They try to solve one problem, but it leaves something else exposed. And that's where we need to understand that, like, every theological position has those types of things. No, there, on any theological topic, there's no sense of saying it's just a clean cut solution to the problem. There's always going to be something, which is also showing maybe our Western mindset of how we like to harmonize and synthesize things.
Yeah.
And we're not taking into account we're reading ancient Eastern writers. But every theological position, whether it's premillennialism or amillennialism, has something to account for. What do you do with this? What do you do with this? Okay. And that's us just trying to tie things up too neatly, I think.
Sure. Yeah. And to reinforce that position, with that point that you're making there, because I think some people might even be uncomfortable with what you just said, because everything does fit in a nice, neat little box. And the answer is, okay, so we have the doctrine of the Trinity. We get it. We understand it. Mm-hmm. But do you really comprehend it?
No.
We cannot really comprehend the nature and the essence of who God even is. So certainly we should be content at times with tension in the text and not fully understanding exactly the nature of all these things. And okay, great. If Christ returns and establishes a reign from Jerusalem for 1,000 years, I guess we're premillennialists. If Christ returns and brings us all to the New Jerusalem, I guess we're all amillennialists.
Yeah. So last week we looked at chapter 9, verse 1, and then compared that with 20, verse 1 through 3.
Yeah.
And you were suggesting that these two passages are linked. People don't, like we said, most of the time, I think we just start with the question of the millennium in chapter 20 is we just parachute into chapter 20 itself, and we're not looking at the structure of the rest of the book because we think, oh, it's linear. Right. Chapter 9 already happened. We don't need to pay attention to that event anymore. Chronologically, it already happened. But you wanted to connect that to say, hey, there's an angel that opens the abyss in chapter 9, verse 2. It releases the demonic horde. However, in 20, verse 3, the angel throw Satan into it and he shuts it, but there's some sort of connection. We have an abyss, we have an angel, so we need to look at that. So what do is there anything we need to revisit there? How do we continue thinking about chapter 9 as we go in to continue through chapter 20 today?
So let me maybe briefly recap again. We said this last time, but it's a podcast. You're probably not sitting there taking notes per se. So let's kind of recap what we discussed last week, bring us back to this conversation. So in chapter 20, verse 1, it says, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. As you noted, he's going to throw the devil into the abyss, and then in verse 3, he's going to shut it and seal it over him. Right, then you skip back to chapter 9. Now, in chapter 9, it says, verse 1, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven, which is similar to an angel from heaven, which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to it, or to him, and he opened the pit, and smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So you have, in one passage, an angel with a key throwing Satan in and closing the abyss. And another one, you have an angel with a key opening the abyss. And it seems, these two passages might be parallel to one another. The point of that was we have these literary connections, rhetorical links between chapter 9 and chapter 20. The clear link starts with the fact that both passages, chapter 9 and chapter 20, begin with an angelic being having a key to the abyss. In one place, he opens the abyss, chapter 9, and in the other, he closes the abyss. I think that what's happening actually is that the closing of the abyss in chapter 20 must precede the opening of the abyss in chapter 9.
One thing that comes up with this, and we addressed it last week, but it's good to remind ourselves because this is actually a significant point, is in chapter 20, we read this idea of Satan being bound. And this seems like this comes out of nowhere. This is the first time we see this in scripture. But our question is, would John's readers or hearers, would they have already known that Satan has already been bound? And do we see this anywhere else in the New Testament story? Or is this just a new future thing that happens?
Exactly. That means that we're a little bit cautious here because we're assuming something. Mm-hmm. We're assuming that when they heard Satan being bound for 1,000 years, they already had an idea what that meant. And that makes sense because
But John, it's an argument from silence.
It's an argument from silence because mm-hmm. John just says it as though you guys know what I'm talking about. If there is a parallel to the binding of Satan, it would have to be Mark chapter 3. And we discussed that in the first and the second episodes on the millennium. So we won't go into great detail here. But Jesus says he went into Satan's house and he bound the strong man. And that's how he's casting out demons. That's Mark chapter 3. So if that's the case, then it makes sense that John's readers already have an idea that the devil's already been bound. And that explains why in verses 1, 2, and 3, he goes back to describe Satan as always a new character in the story, because he's providing this context as if it's the beginning, because they already have this, I think, beginning thing. If that's the case, then chapter 20, verse 7, and the Satan being released from the abyss corresponds with chapter 9, verse 1, with the angelic being coming down from heaven with the key and opening the abyss in chapter 9, verses 1, 2, and 3. And if so, then chapter 9 and the war, which we're going to get into more now, corresponds with the war in chapter 16, 19, and 21. I think that's something that we need to explore.
Yeah. So in that war is, we would say this is the war and is Armageddon, right?
Yeah. It's called Armageddon chapter 16. So sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's the same war. So we find out in 16 that it's Armageddon. So then does Armageddon happen once Satan is released from the abyss in verse 7 of chapter 20? Is that when we should assume Armageddon happens?
Yeah, the problem with the question, of course, is it's like the listener, whoever's asking the question, yourself in this instance, or the person who's listening, they have a certain conception of what Armageddon is. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I say yes, I'm saying yes, what I think Armageddon means, and might not correspond with what you think it means.
So like in a nutshell, what's the pop, like a quick, like a the tweet version, okay. What is Armageddon then from a popular standpoint?
From a popular standpoint, Armageddon is a literal battle that takes place in the fields of Megiddo, which is a valley north of Jerusalem in Judea, Samaria. And it's a literal battle between the armies of the world and Christ and his armies, or maybe Israel, Jerusalem, something like that. But it's a physical war that takes place right before the second coming of Jesus. My definition of Armageddon is it's the battle that Satan wages against the people of God. And he's been waging that war since the beginning of time. It's specifically, if you want to limit it to the war that takes place after Christ resurrects and ascends and Satan's kicked out of heaven, chapter 12, that's fine. But it's a war that Satan wages against the people of God throughout all of time. And that's especially what that war in chapter 11 with the war against the two witnesses in chapter 11, verse 7.
You said my definition of Armageddon. What would you say is this, if there is a standard, or is there a standard definition or understanding of Armageddon from the rest of the amillennial or scholarly community that's not dispensational?
Yeah, I guess it's probably something along the lines of what I just said. I think the scholarly world, just like the Armageddon passage in chapter 16, which that's where the word Armageddon occurs, is just, hey, that's just the war that happens against God's people, and they just don't make much of it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So while it's a huge part of the schema in dispensationalism, for every other system, it's not.
No, it's just because the word war is used throughout the book of Revelation to describe the war that Satan's using, waging against God's people.
Okay. So once again, though, it's going back to saying you believe that what we see in chapter 16, chapter 19, chapter 20, it's the same war. And so this is all referring to Armageddon, even though the name Armageddon is only referenced once in chapter 16.
Exactly. So that's, and this becomes really critical to understanding the Armageddon passage and the millennium passage. What we have actually is three descriptions of this war. In chapter 16, verses 12 through 16, it's a description of what's called Armageddon, but it's the sixth bowl. And it says that the sixth angel, verse 12, poured out his bowl in the great river Euphrates, as water was dried up, that the way might be prepared for the kings of the whole earth coming from the east, or the kings coming from the east. There's the demonic spirits that we alluded to in verse 13 and 14 that come out, and they go out to the kings of the whole world, verse 14, to gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. Verse 16, they gather them together to the place in Hebrew that it's called Armageddon. That's the frame for this war. But it seems to be this is the exact same war that's described in chapter 19, and I'll make an argument as to why that is in a minute. In chapter 19, verses 17 through 21, we have the judgment of the beast and the false prophet. And verse 17, it says, an angel was standing in the sun, and he shouts, come assemble for the great supper of God to all the birds flying him in heaven. And it says in verse 18, that you can eat the flesh of kings, commanders, mighty men, horses, and those who sit on them, the flesh of all men, both free and slave, and small and great. Verse 19, I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and his army. And then the beast was seized, they're thrown in the lake of fire, and that's the end. Then in chapter 20, the passage that we're discussing here in terms of the millennium, in verse 7, it says, when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan's released from his prison, and it will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together for the war. The number is like the sand of the seashore. They come upon the broad plain of the earth. They surround the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire comes down from heaven and devour them, and then the devil is thrown in the lake of fire. So you have three accounts describing this war, and I put down there for you, Vinny, in the Greek there, as you can see it. The phrase, to gather them together for the war, in chapter 16, verse 14, in chapter 20, verse 8, is identical in the Greek. And that's an extended phrase. Now, in chapter 19, verse 19, it's going to be translated very similarly, to gather them together for the war. But notice that it doesn't have the pronoun, no big deal, them. Synago is a participial form. It's not an infinitive. And it adds the infinitive to make. So while gathering them together to make the war might be like a wooden translation, something along those lines. But the fact that this is same language is used, and it's identical in 16, 14, and 20, verse 8, almost demands us to understand the war of Satan being led out of the abyss in 20, verses 7 and 8 as the identical war as the Armageddon war in chapter 16, 12 through 16.
Second, which is also point, why it's important to recognize that even in my translation, it does this in 20, verse 8, it says it's to gather them for battle. But it should be consistently translated as war, like you saw in 1919.
In 1614 and 1919, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's where you're going to make sure it's consistent. It's talking about the same thing. Our English translations don't get it consistent.
Yeah, and that's a shame because the Greek is identical in 1614 and 20 verse 8 and very similar in 1919.
Yep.
Right, that's the first point, why these three passages must be read together. The second point is the verb gather only occurs in these three accounts. Mm. It occurs five times, but twice in 16, verses 14 to 16, twice in the description of the judgment of the beast and the false prophet, 19, verses 17 and 19, and then once in the account of the judgment of the dragon. All five occurrences occur only in these three accounts. This is the only time that the word gather occurs. Mm-hmm. My third point is, the war which Satan wages upon his release in 20, verse 7, is waged by the nations who are in the four corners of the earth in 20 verse 8. But in 1614, the war is waged by the kings of the whole world. And in 1919, it's waged by the kings of the earth and their armies. Just three various descriptions of the same thing. It's all the kings of the world are gathering together for the war. So it's not three different wars. Fourth point now, is they're all linked by the explicit indication of the enemies of Christ and the people of God. In other words, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. So in chapter 16, verses 12 through 16, all three of them were mentioned, the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. In 19, verse 17, the beast and the false prophet are mentioned. And in chapter 20, verses 1 through 10, the dragon is mentioned. There again, it seems that we have three descriptions of the same account, and the literary connections are pretty explicit. You've got to read the war in 20, verse 7, in light of the war of Armageddon in chapter 16 and the war in chapter 19.
But why have three different accounts of this? Why not just state it once? We only have one account of Revelation 4 and 5 and the throne room scene and all this worship. Why not just do this once as well?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a fair question. It's simply the way that John's kind of drawing out his narrative. It's part of his narrative strategy. In the Armageddon passage, it's put in the context of the sixth bowl. And that kind of serves as like the introductory account of this, what we might call the eschatological war, the eschatological battle, which I think happens throughout all of time. In this first account, we learn that the war is the work of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. They deceive the nations or the kings of the whole world, and they gather together to wage war. Remember, this war affects God's people because they're told in verse 15, that parenthetical insertion, like, hey, stay awake. So we know that this war is against God's people, but it's not explicitly stated there. Mm-hmm. And then in chapter 20, verses 1 through 10, you then have the war stated again in the context of the final judgment. So in 1917 through 21, we again have the war, but now it's the war of the beast and the false prophet. And then in the next passage, of course, it'll be the war of the dragon. And of course, it's against the people of God. Specifically, it says in verse 19 of chapter 19, it says, they wage war against the one sitting upon his horse and against his army. So now it's explicit. Oh, this is against Christ and against his people. And so we know. And then, of course, the beast and the false prophet thrown in the lake of fire. Then in chapter 20, again, you have the war being described or attributed to the work of the dragon. So 16 was all three of them, 19, 17 through 21, just the two. And then in this present account, the dragon.
I think, though, it's just continuing to make the point that John is not trying to create something literal that we are to read. This is not a roadmap. This has never hit me before until we were reading it earlier. But when you read 19, verse 17, it says, then I saw an angel standing in the sun. Right. You can't see an angel standing in the sun. like so much of the description is not meant to be literal.
You also can't talk about the eclipse that happened the other day as we record this, and that was close to the end of the world. If the sun becomes black, you can't see the moon.
Exactly.
The moon becomes blood, and the sun becomes black. No, if the sun becomes black, you can't see the moon becoming red. So, yeah, these apocalyptic descriptions are certainly not meant to be taken literally. And again,
so we would assume then it's not meant to be literal when John's talking about a literal war. War. Yeah.
So here's where I think we want to be careful, because what often happens is it's either literal or it's spiritual. Don't make that false dichotomy, right? That's a secular way of thinking of things. Now, that's often an accusation against someone like ourselves or myself. We'll say, oh, if you don't think it's literal, you're just spiritualizing everything. No, that's not what's happening or what I'm discussing. So it's a literal war that the dragon wages against Christ and the people of God. It's not a literal war that it happens with guns and F-14s flying overhead and dropping bombs on battlefields between nations. But it is a literal war. It happens every single day, especially to our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. Mm-hmm. The church has been suffering persecution for centuries now, for millennium now, and that is what the war against God's people is all about. Call that Armageddon if you, that's fine. And his primary weapon is deception. And I think the fact that the Western church is so locked into, oh, it's a literal war in the battlefield, we've actually been deceived because we're not looking for the war that Satan's waging against his people. Against God's people.
Yeah. So I don't know. This is why in the middle of the description of this war of Armageddon, do you think this is why in chapter 16, verse 15, he kind of slips in this exhortation to God's people, and he said, blessed is the one who stays awake.
Yeah.
So we're to be woke.
Exactly. Yeah. There you go. Thank you. Don't go down that path, Vinny. Yeah. This is going to get us in trouble. I'm already in enough trouble. I'll get in trouble on that path later on.
Yeah.
Exactly. The whole point of the Armageddon passage that we discussed earlier was that it's against God's people, as evidenced by the fact that you have this parenthetical exhortation says, hey, blessed are those who stay awake. Why do we have to stay awake and keep our clothes with us if Armageddon doesn't affect us? Have we been raptured out of the story and we're no longer even present? No, it absolutely affects us. And I think that's what the verses 4 through 6 in chapter 20 are describing. That is, God's people are victorious. Mm-hmm. And that victoriousness must correspond with what the beast is doing in terms of being bound and still, but yet still wreaking havoc.
Hey, everyone. We want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast. And we want to remind you that everything we provide at Determined Truth is free of charge. And this even includes all of the teaching that Rob does on a weekly basis to pastors in India and around the world. We don't have any supporters that get special behind-the-scenes access. But we can only do this with the generous support that comes from those of you who can afford to give. So if you would prayerfully consider supporting us with anything from $5 a month or more, we will continue to work hard to challenge the church to be the church. To give, go to DeterminedTruth.com and click on the Give tab or follow the link in the show notes.
Any questions you have outstanding in terms of what I'm doing with the text here? And if not, what do you think is the significance of this conversation for maybe you and for maybe people in your church that you might be teaching, or how would you counsel somebody or instruct somebody on the importance of this whole conversation?
I think the first issue that we have to struggle through is almost having permission or needing permission to not have to read the text in a chronological, linear sort of way.
Okay.
Because if I'm listening to you teach this for the first time, I'm just probably struggling with, but that's not the way I'm taught how to read stories. That's not the way how I'm taught how to, what to expect of the Bible. And we need to come back to saying that while there's times where we've said, this isn't intended to be literal, or this isn't intended to be the physical thing, we're still saying it's all true.
Yes, absolutely.
And so
way more true than you might think.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's no, everything that John says is absolutely true. It just might not literally be creating a word picture of what you ought to expect. And, and I know for me, it just took years to get to that point.
Yeah.
To be okay to not have to function the way of thinking.
It literally took you years?
Literally. Three and a half years.
Okay.
So I think I could just really empathize with folks who might be hearing this and just struggling through it.
I understand.
So that's the first thing. The second thing, and I've even experienced this recently in context counseling with folks within the local church. And you have instances that pop up where you might have conflict between people. Maybe there's someone who is fearful of an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. And when you, without giving, you know, specifics, just being general, because I think it could apply to anything. But you oftentimes have someone who is maybe less aware of the dynamic in a relationship, and they just assume that so-and-so is not actively raging and yelling and screaming, therefore we're good. Mm-hmm. And so they think that the absence of physical rage means we're okay, that everything's okay. And I had to use this analogy with someone the other day in a counseling session where I said, we're going to deal with this person who's difficult, and they're not going to come out and be Hiroshima. They're not going to be an atom bomb dropping where it's just like utter devastation and they're screaming and raging and whatnot. What they're probably going to be doing is acting out in a more cyber war kind of way. You don't know what's happening. It's stealth, but it's affecting you where it's like termites, where it's eating you from the inside and you have no clue what's actually happening. And this is, I use that to say, this is oftentimes, I think, what's happening in the book of Revelation, where we're so busy looking for the physical war. We want to know when the 200 million troops are physically descending on a plot of land that we could find on Google Earth and live stream. And so we're looking for the wrong things, because so much of, I think, what's happening in this war is, it's something you're not going to be able to see. It's termites devouring away and eating away at something. And then you don't even know it's there until too late. And so we just need to be looking for the right things.
Yeah. And the right things, of course, is following Christ and following the Lamb, taking up our cross and denying Him. And I think the more we do that, the more difficult it becomes. And we begin to experience the essence of the kingdom. I think the other thing about that is, when we look at this from this literalist perspective that you've been discussing, that's only to be done from a Western perspective. Mm-hmm. Because the rest of the church is experiencing what we're discussing, and they're experiencing trauma, they're experiencing conflict, they're experiencing opposition, they're experiencing Satan's attack, they're experiencing the fact that home church in China just got shut down and somebody got arrested. They're experiencing these things. So when we turn around and say, oh, Armageddon isn't here, oh, the tribulation isn't here, our brothers and sisters are going like, what are you guys talking about? Do not realize this. And we're recording this in 2024. Obviously, we're just a little bit more than six months and a few days into the war on Gaza and October 7th and what happened with Hamas and Israel and all that good stuff there. And I mentioned this before, but on October 8th, the very next day after Hamas's attack, Greg Laurie, a pastor in Southern California, prominent pastor, an evangelical pastor, gets up and says, we should be looking up into the heavens right now, because this is clearly a sign of Christ's return, because it's a war in Israel. Mm-hmm. And how tragic that we knew on October 8th, at least those of us that were involved in the issue, what this was going to mean for Gaza, which today means 33,000 dead, 70-some-odd thousand injured, 17,000 children that are now orphans, and it means almost all the infrastructure in Gaza is decimated. 1.9, if not more, million people have been displaced. This is not good for Israel or for Gaza or for the Palestinians. And yet Greg Laurie's one, and they actually, his congregation, by the way, applauded when he said, we should be looking up into the heavens, and we should be excited. No, we should be weeping right now. We should be grieving right now. Mm-hmm. So this, as you can imagine, really angers and upsets me. That's a clear indication of the church being deceived. Mm-hmm. If you want to see the book of Revelation in motion, there you go. The first seal is false prophets and false teaching. And I'm not calling Greg Laurie a false prophet. I'm saying that's false teaching.
Yeah. The content of what he said was wrong.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And he's mm-hmm. deceiving his congregation. And as a result of that, we're rejoicing at war. You've got to be kidding me. Mm. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who mourn, who grieve. Mm-hmm. That's what we should be doing. And so I think this is a very serious issue that we in the West have got to stop reading the Bible as though it's about our Western worldview. It's not. Jesus wasn't a Westerner. He was an ancient Near Eastern person in a Greco-Roman context. And Isaiah was in an ancient Near Eastern context. And I think the scriptures tell us we need to get back to following Christ and what that means by loving our neighbors and our enemies and following him wherever he might lead us and realize that this war is going on ever present against our brothers and sisters in Christ.
It's funny. The other day on Twitter, I saw an image and it was a picture from outer space. It's like an AI thing or something. Okay. It's from outer space looking at Earth and all it was ocean. And there was only one continent on there. It wasn't North America. It was just America. And the caption said something like how evangelicals think Bible prophecy works. It's something to that effect.
Wow.
And you already alluded to how 2 days ago in real time. So we're recording on Wednesday. On this past Monday is when we had the solar eclipse.
Yeah.
And in my Sunday school class, having to go through and just take a pastoral moment to remind our folks, like, guys, don't freak out. The rapture is literally not happening tomorrow. Like, just taking that moment, because we have these things all the time that pop up.
Yeah.
But even there, like, we always think everything has to do with what's happening in America. Eclipses in America are indicative of the return of Christ. Wars that have to do with us, or lockdowns and COVID that have to do with America. We don't care what the rest of the world does, but when America loses their freedoms, like, everything is so America-centric. And it's just such an ignorant way of thinking, because we literally think that we're the center of the universe and we just have such a bigger world. We don't care about, we care much more about people who share our own passports than brothers and sisters who actually share our own faith and our family spiritual DNA, if you will. And it's just a huge issue where we just think there's America, American Christians, and then the rest of the world. And that's just not how the world works. And that's not how God's economy works and God's kingdom works.
Or how the Bible works. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
We did it.
We did it, man. Are we done with
the problems? 20? Well, we got 11 through 15 to do. So we'll do 11 through 15 and try to get through 21 through 8 next week. And then we'll get into the New Jerusalem in 2 weeks, but no promises.
We didn't address Gog and Magog, really, did we?
Oh, Gog and Magog is just another reference to the armies of the whole world gathering together to make war. That's all it is.
Yeah.
It's Ezekiel's framing of the whole thing.
And even in Ezekiel's reference here, because what is this, 38 and 39 of Ezekiel?
Yeah, 37, 38, and 39. 38 and 39, but the context is larger. 36, really. Yeah.
And so we would say, just to leave that kind of tidied up, it's not referring to literal people. This has nothing to do with Russia, Ukraine.
No.
This is just describing the
kings of the world.
The kings of the world and how they're going to continue to oppress God's people.
Yeah. Yeah. In Ezekiel, it probably should be translated Gog of the land of Magog.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
As it's if not Gog and Magog are two different things. Yeah. Gog of the land of Magog, and Gog just becomes this embodiment of what Revelation might call, or what the New Testament might call, the Antichrist, or maybe popular dispensationalism might call the Antichrist. That's all. It's just the kings of the whole world. That's all it is. Really quickly here, what John seems to be doing very much so at the end of the book of Revelation, especially, and maybe you can make an argument for the larger book of Revelation, is he's actually following the story of the book of Ezekiel.
Yeah.
So as Ezekiel 36 through 48 are playing out, that linear pattern actually seems to be followed from Revelation chapter 16 all the way through chapter 22. So I think that actually does work, and you fit that then into here, and Gog and Magog is simply another description of this cosmic war.
Yeah, because in that structure in Ezekiel 36, 37, that's where you have God restoring his people. Mm-hmm. 40 through 48 is the rebuilding of the temple.
Right.
But in the midst of this, you're still going to have people persecuting you, even though God's doing this thing, which is exactly what's happening in Revelation. God's doing this thing with his people, but guess what? You're still going to have the beasts and the kings of this world still persecuting you. But guess what? It's all good.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It was actually not as hard as people want to make it.
No.
Yeah. Great. Hey, we'll finish up to chapter 20 next time, hopefully get into 21. And look at us. Yeah. We're only a couple pages away from finishing the book.
Very cool.
All right, everyone. Hope Yep. I hope you guys have a great rest of your spring. Are we in April still for people in real time?
I think so.
April, May. We got some good guests coming up.
We
once we finish, that will be fun. And yeah, we won't give that away. But yeah, we'll see you guys soon. Bye-bye.
I want to thank you for joining us on today's podcast. And we would love for you to share the work of Determined Truth with others. Please follow this podcast and give a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Your review will go a long way towards helping others find this podcast. Then, share it with others so that we can get the word of the gospel of the kingdom to more people.